things. This is Dan Galadner, Wayne State University, Walter P. Ruther Library, AFT Archivist, May 23rd, 2006, interviewing Tom Hobart for the AFT Oral History Project. Thank you, Tom, for participating in the Oral History Project.
I'm happy to do it.
Appreciate it. Why don't we just get started with where you're born, raised, and a bit about your mother and father.
Okay. I was born in Buffalo, Sisters Hospital, on Main Street, in 1936, during the Depression, before the war. We had an unusual family. My dad was a college graduate. He graduated University of Michigan in 1928 with a degree in engineering. He was a civil engineer, but he had worked in hydro, so he ended up building waterworks for cities. And my mom even had been to college. My grandfather, who was the first Italian policeman on the Buffalo Police Force, he had had to lower the height requirement to hire him because they needed somebody to speak Italian to sign the mafia in town and to sign the mafia out of town, because Buffalo was an R&R for the mafia back in those days. And so he worked all during the Depression. And my father's family worked too, because his dad worked for his wife's family, which he hated. He had been he and my grandmother married very late in life. She was in her 30s, which in those days was unheard of for somebody to be single that long. And her family had ties to Hopkins, who was on the upper deck on the Mayflower. So they were in the gas and oil business. They were one of the oil wells that came in right after Titusville. And then they specialized in natural gas. And it was a very well-to-do family. Unfortunately, we were the other branch. We got the land rights at a farm in Pennsylvania that was all rocks, and somebody else got the gas and oil rights. And so my grandfather had lived in Iowa. He was born in New York State, but near the Finger Lakes, and then I guess got too crowded in that part of the world, so they had to go to Iowa where there was more elbow room. And then the Depression of '06, he managed a lumber yard, and it went broke, and they had no way to support their family with a new child, so they begged to work for my grandmother's family, and the family granted him that request, but reminded him every day that they had begged for the job. So my grandfather didn't like it, but he kept working during the Depression, so we did not suffer the way that other families had. And in around 1940, my father went to work for the First Army, working for the Corps of Engineers, and was exempted from the war for that, and worked for the Corps of Engineers throughout the war. He built waterworks in Albany, Georgia, at an army camp. He remodeled them in Albany. In Tullahoma, Tennessee, he finally got his life's dream. He built the waterworks for a camp of 30,000 men, and I guess that was a substantial city to build the waterworks from. So, and then he ended up at First Army Headquarters in Jacksonville, Florida, for the remainder of the war. And then became the top civil service engineer in America. He was Secretary of the Commandant of the Engineering Corps, and was part of a company that was going to do the Marshall Plan work. But he had a relapse of tuberculosis and was unable to go to Europe and went to a sanitarium here. Died 4 years later. I guess they would have made a lot of money, because what happened, we had 5 million men and women to bring back. We didn't want to bring any equipment back, and it all got sold to this engineering company. They bought Jeeps for a quarter, and trucks for 50 cents and tanks for a dollar. Those became the assets of the engineering company that rebuilt Europe. And then they were required to turn it over to locals within a short period of time under the Marshall Plan. 3 or 4 years, they had to turn everything over. And it had to be paid for by who they were turning it over to. So, you know, these assets, you know, a tank with a bulldozer on the front was a bulldozer. And so they all came back and had substantial engineering firms in America. And my mom, who had been to pharmacy school but didn't graduate, had no business skills, and there was not a lot of jobs for women. So she was a clerk in a drugstore. And the only reason I guess we got by is we lived with my grandmother and my aunt. My grandmother had a $25 a month pension from the police force, and my aunt had a job, so between that and my mother's pay as a clerk, we got by. In fact, the year I was 16, I got a job at the Buffalo News, which was the first full-time job I had, or it was a part-time job, but it was a substantial job. I stuck pins before that in a bowling alley. And before the pin setting machines, I got out before they invented the pin setting machines. I was displaced. But the first summer, my mom cried when I came home with my paycheck. I was making a dollar a week more than she was, and that really hurt her. But anyway, we did all right. She remarried again, and my brother and I survived fairly well, and I went on to...
What kind of neighborhood did you grow up in?
It was a German neighborhood. So unfortunately, it was a working-class German neighborhood. In 1946, it was not a place for an Italian family to live, since these were all Nazis during the war, and they felt Mussolini had let Hitler down. And they made sure that they reminded us of that often in that neighborhood. Buffalo was a very ethnic city. There was a German neighborhood, a Polish neighborhood, an Irish neighborhood, a black neighborhood, and then the WASP neighborhood that was there. There was a small Jewish community that grew up there, but everybody lived in their own sections. And I remember my grandmother was just very upset the first time my cousin Patsy dated a German guy. You know, how dare you? And said, well, you know, my mom married an English guy, you know. That was all right, but we don't have to do that anymore. So I went on to engineering school like everybody expected me to, and fucked out the first year.
Not
your thing? It was a Jesuit school, and the Jesuits had a conclave in which they tried to figure out why not enough Catholic young men were taking their proper role in American society. And they came to the conclusion it was because of the poor curriculum being offered in the Jesuit institutions. And so they came back and they made the curriculum a lot more difficult without telling us that there was a change. And they fired all the professors that didn't have PhDs, and so those professors didn't help us a lot. We didn't help ourselves either. So I joined the Air Force. I was going to be an air cadet, but...
what year was that when you joined the Air Force?
It was 1956. And I got down to I can't think of the Air Force Base in Texas. And took one more eye exam, and they sent me home immediately. And when I told them that the recruiting officer had told me that, you know, they could grind my goggles to meet my prescription, the colonel said, "He told you what? I can let you fly." I guess the planes were only worth a couple hundred thousand dollars. I'm like, I'll let you fly a plane with grind goggles. So I came back home, and I got a job as a fourth helper on the open hearth at Bethlehem Steel, which was a terrific job because they had to break down the open hearth furnaces every 24 hours. So if you had an 8-hour shift, you missed a couple breakdowns. And it was a shitty job, but it was hot in hell. You had to take all the bricks down, clean out all the sludge, and then rebuild the furnace, all the bricks up, and wait for the next application. So mom cried. She felt that dad was a college graduate. She had a year of college, and I was fourth helper on the open hearth. I also had a job at the Buffalo Evening News, so I was rolling money during that period. I mean, I was really well-to-do.
What'd you do with the Buffalo News?
I took care of the newsboys, stopped the paper, added the paper, delivered the paper if the newsboy didn't show up. But she was upset, so my stepfather was on the board of directors for the pharmacy school at the University of Buffalo. He wanted me to go out there. I didn't like my stepfather. I wasn't about to become a pharmacist, primarily because he was one. So I went to Buffalo State, we used to go to the lunch hours when I was at Canisius College. That's where we used to get our dates for the weekend, because it was all teacher college, had a lot of women there. And the dean was going down, well, what division you want to go in? Well, Canisius only had one or two divisions. You know, they had pre-med, pre-law, pre-engineering, and liberal arts. I didn't really know what he was talking about when he went into... He did it alphabetically. Art education, exceptional children, home economics, industrial arts. I said, what's that? And he said, well, they make bats. Now, there was a flashback. I remember walking down the street one day, and I went to the parochial school one direction, the public school was the other way. And as I'm coming down, the kids coming from the public school with a bat. Now, in our neighborhood, nobody owned anything. You know, we had an old ball. It was a lot. You know, you had to get a bat at school or something. The kid had his own bat. And I said, where'd you get that from? And he said, I made it. And I had always tried to envision, how the hell would you make a bat? You know, carve it? You know, sand it? How would you make a bat? And so this guy happened to use as his description. He said, you know, they make bats. And I said, geez, I'll take that. And that's how I started in industrial arts education. And I tried to move over to manual arts therapy. This was the end of the Korean War. And I really was interested in manual arts therapy, but they wouldn't let me enter the program because they said I wasn't mature enough. You would have to be dealing with veterans, and I was not a veteran. We had a lot of veterans at school, but they were all older than we were, so they said no. So I didn't move out of that. But I was not enamored with being a teacher at this point. You know, it was just mom had stopped crying as I was going to school, so that was a good thing. And it wasn't until I practice taught that I said, wow, you know, this could be a career. This is really great stuff. So I finished there. Practice teaching, and I was in my senior year, and I didn't get along with the metal shop teacher. He was a pompous man, and I guess it foreshadowed what the future was. He was the vice president of the State School Boards Association, president of the school board at Grand Island. I didn't know really what that meant, but later on I was very happy that I didn't like him. He had a friend that used to run this club, sports car club, and what it was this guy brought in all his sports cars. He was a professor there. He brought in all his sports cars, and we had to polish them and display them and tune them up and all this. Then he would show his cars, and I thought he was really putting a burden on us that we shouldn't have, because you were required to go in there. The metal shop teacher said, you know, if you don't go in there, you're not going to pass this course. So we had to go down there and do it. And there came up an interview for the city of Buffalo, We were doing a lot of interviews at that time, and City of Buffalo was coming in to interview, and both these guys had said, we don't want to see anybody going to those interviews. We're not wasting money training people to work in the city. So I think, well, that's a pretty good endorsement. I think I'll go to the interview. And there was only two of us there, and the guy said that if we would agree to work, I was in an accelerated program. The vets from Korea had this program where they started in August, and they finished on a June, 3.5 years later. I started in September, so I had to finish at the end of January. And so this was a mid-semester interview. And the interviewer said that if we would sign up for a teaching position on February 1st, that they would give us an adult education job immediately, which paid $8 an hour. Back then, it was a federal program. It was, wow, it was big, big money. And so I signed up and got a job at School 54 in the city of Buffalo, which, to my surprise, was a minority school. Because I had, when I was in high school, all my friends were from that area, and it was a solid German neighborhood. And I found out that in about 4 or 5 years' time, they had gone from one African-American student to one white student, total switchover at the school. Of course, I had no training to deal with urban kids, and I practiced teaching them out. One was in a suburb, and one was in a rural area, and kids brought a lot of problems, such as, I remember, disciplining a child for falling asleep in the shop, which is a hard thing to do, you know, because the machine's going and everything. And we had coat rooms off of every classroom, and he had gone back in the coat room and made a nest out of some coats and gone to sleep. And, when the mother came in, she explained that the child was sleepy during the day because they lived in shifts in the apartment that they had, and their shift was 4 p.m. to midnight. And at midnight, they had to leave the apartment. And the kids are on the street from midnight until they went to school in the morning. And colder Buffalo, so
yeah,
it's outside all night. And so I learned that there was an awful lot that you had to know about culture of the children. You know, it wasn't the parochial school that I'd gone to, you know, where if anybody acted up, they threw them out, and I went to a public school. So that was my beginning. There was a minimum salary law in Buffalo, and it, minimum salary law, I think it was $3,500 a year. And the association had lobbied to increase it to 4,000, and they were successful in doing that. But because of that, Buffalo laid off 8 industrial arts teachers, and there were 8 retirements that year, so I got laid off.
First
the
year?
Only one. First one. The only one to get laid off.
What year was this?
This was 1960. This is after I completed one semester, because I started in February. Semester. And so I went down to the personnel office, and the director of personnel, Jack Migliori, had said, I got a special ed class you could teach. And I said, well, I'm not really prepared for that. I've got an English class you can teach. I said, yeah, I don't think I have a strength in English. He said, well, why don't you join the Army? So I went down, I joined the reserves, and I went off almost immediately to basic training, and did my 6 months reserve time, and came back home in the middle of a semester again. And so I substituted for a while, and I did an awful lot of substitutes. So a lot of inner city, I learned a lot about kids. at my first Spanish-speaking child, you know, she didn't speak any English. I went to the office to tell them that she didn't speak English. I was having difficulty instructing her, and they said, "Is she causing you trouble?" And I said, "No." And they said, "Well, what's your complaint?"
So this is basically your guidance into urban education.
Yes.
Basically straight off the boat, in a way.
Yeah. And then I made a racist decision. An industrial arts job opening up. You know, the big thing in industrial arts is wood and metal. And a wood and metal shop opened up at an inner city school. And a printing job opened up at Bennett High School, which was the premier high school in Buffalo. It was protected, you know, it didn't have, all the kids that went there were bright. It was like Lake Wobegon in Wisconsin, you know. All the kids were above average, and I didn't know a damn thing about teaching printing, but I took the printing job, and I went to Bennett High School. So I started in September teaching printing, and fortunately for me, I still had the job at the Buffalo News, and the head of the linotype department at the News was a great guy, and he used to help me do the lesson plans for the next day all the time. So we had two platen presses, and we were supposed to do etching and linoleum block carving and all of this photography. It also had a ceramics section, which I immediately gave off to the art teacher, because type and ceramics don't go together. You know, it was a mess in that place, and dusty, and the type boxes were full of dust, and you know. So I started, and things were going well. I kept a job at the News. I was making more at the News, and I was making teaching. And then we had a radio station, WKBW, and they used to announce the breaking news with a gong. And it's called gong, you know, bulletin, and so, 423rd Ordnance Company has been activated. So I call up the sergeant and say, "What the hell does activated mean?" "It's activated mean you get your ass down here tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock. I said, "I got to teach school tomorrow morning. I can't come down." "Maybe you didn't hear me." Yeah. So next day, you know, I called in for a substitute, went down there, and I'm one of the few that showed up down there, so they took pity on me, and they let me finish out the week at school before I had to report again. And then we were off for the Berlin crisis. So we were at Fort Devens and outside of Massachusetts. During those days, what happened was that the reserve replaced a Ready Army unit. The Ready Army unit went over, so the automobile ordnance unit left Fort Devens, went over to Germany to support the Berlin Wall, and we moved in and we took over their duties on the post, which was a bad duty because we had to do our basic training all over again. So we had to do that at night. So we had to work all day. We had to do basic training at night. It was a pretty intense time there. And a time I wasn't prepared for. When I'd gone into basic training, you know, I had known I was there for 6 months. It was going to be a tough time. And, you know, when you weren't getting paid very much, we got $78 a month. There wasn't much money, you know, go around. You did your 6 months and went back into civilian life and did your reserve duty on weekends. But now this time you went in and you know, you're spending money all the time. You know, I was in talk up to my ears about it. So I figured I got to get the hell out of here. You know, this is because you know, Cape Cod was only about 45 miles away. We were coming back at 4:30 in the morning from Cape Cod to, you know, get in line to fall in for the reveille in the morning. So they had a unit going up to Alaska to support the war games. The Alaskan scouts were paid, they're the National Guard up in Alaska. They were paid when they walked north to look left, and when they walked south to look right. And if they saw the Russians coming, to report it. And And then once a year, there was an engagement between the Alaskan Scouts and the U.S. forces. And we went up to take the vehicles out of cold storage, make them ready for combat. And then we stayed longer and put them back in cold storage, you know, for the next time. So I did a lot of time up there. I got a direct commission while I was there. I had a cousin that was joining the reserves in 1939. And when it came to separation in 45, all the reservists were kept in to separate the troops. He didn't get out to 46, so he was in for 7 years, and most people were only in for five. And I thought, oh boy, I don't want to be doing KP for 7 years. So I applied to the Medical Service Corps for a direct commission from Congress, and I got it. But in the interim, I was separated from active duty. And Daddy and I had been going together, and when the commission came in, all you had to do was get it signed by any U.S. officer you were in, and you were second lieutenant. And the problem was I was 26. When you turned 26, automatically second lieutenants were made first lieutenants. But if you came in as a second lieutenant, you'd get your full 2 years before you became a first lieutenant. So I was going to be, you know, one of the old guys that was there at the bottom of the rung. And Daddy wasn't interested in a military career, so I've still got the papers. I've never had them signed to go in. I had a plan. I was going to go in. Medical Service Corps is a shit job. The doctors had established because they didn't want to pull duty.
Okay.
So the highest ranking medical officer was the officer in command. So you could only go to a full colonel in the Medical Service Corps. You couldn't go to a general officer. But if you got in, you were an officer, and you could go to school as a student officer rather than as an officer cadet. And that was a big difference. And that's why I had gone for it. And I thought I could always go to Ranger School and then, you know, move out of Medical Service Corps into one of the active branches. But that would have entailed a full military career, and we got married instead. So that's true enough. So I left the Army as a staff sergeant because when we were separated from duty, everybody who had had at least 2 full years was allowed to go in the inactive reserves. So there's only 18 of us left in the unit. And so we all made rapid advancement in the unit. And so I was in charge of the motor pool when I finally was discharged from the Army. So back to Bennett High School and the printing shop and the regular life, one that you will know about. My daughter Elizabeth was born, and then the three wise men appeared again, and then daughter Catherine was born, and then they came back once more, and my son was born. And I kept a job at the news because we had to feed the family, and Daddy was making more money than I was as a teacher in the suburbs. So when she became pregnant, our income was cut in half. If you want a shock in your marriage life, you know, you got to experience that you have so much less money to get by. But I would complain a lot about it, and one day somebody said, hey, you got a big mouth, why don't you go down to the Buffalo Teachers Federation?
The beginning of the...
So I went to a faculty meeting, and the principal announced that the alternate delegate had quit, and he was appointing science teacher said, no way, I got tenure, I'm not going to do that.
How did you join it? Were you a member?
Everybody was a member.
Everybody was a member type thing. Okay.
You know, when I was at my first assignment, there were double doors on the shop, and they came flying open. The principal stood there, and she said, we're 100% school, and you're ruining it for us. Now, what am I doing? She said, you're not a member of your professional organization. And I said, yes, I am. I'm a member of the International Industrial Arts Association. And she said, I don't know what that is. You're going to join the Buffalo Teachers Federation and the New York State Teachers Association. And by the way, we don't join that radical NEA.
Oh, really?
So I paid $17. Dottie wasn't too happy about $17, a lot of money then. And you had to pay it cash up front. And uh, It was $11 to the state, and for that you got the magazine, and $6 the Buffalo Teachers Federation, and for that I got the right to go to the fashion show. So when I got to Bennett and there was an opening, I volunteered for it, which took a lot of hazing from the people that had volunteered to go down to the association. And I said to the ranking delegate, Bennett was a big school, and everybody was a member of the Buffalo Teachers Federation there. And so I said to the ranking delegate, where's the meeting? And she said to me, why would you want to know? So I could go. She said, why would you want to go? I said, well, because I got elected alternate delegate. You were appointed by the principal, she said. And he's appointed me as the ranking delegate. And I go for the whole delegation. I think we had four delegates and four alternates. And she was the only one that went to any of the meetings.
Okay.
So I went to the first meeting. I found out where it was and went down there. And the first issue to come up was that I paid attention to anyway, because I didn't know what was going on in the room. Somebody made a motion that there should be at least 50% teachers on every committee. And so I asked the lady sitting next to me, who else were on the committee? She says, well, the administrators. And there was a parade of administrators who were all past presidents of the Buffalo Teachers Federation who said how upset they were that after all the work they'd done for teachers, that teachers were slapping them in the face. I said, geez, just the majority is going to be teachers, So the vote came, and I don't remember the exact vote, but I know there were only four votes yes. There were about 200 delegates at a meeting. Four yes votes. And after it failed, a motion was made that the schools of these four people should be notified of how they voted. So that didn't bother me too much, because when you're young, if I got fired, I'd get another job. I mean, I wasn't too concerned about they'd had a picnic during the summer at the former principal's house. And after we all eaten, he announced that the new teachers would do the dishes. And I said, well, wait a minute, who decided this? And he said, I decided that. I said, well, who are you? You're the host here. I'll do my dish and I'll do yours. I'm not doing everybody's dish. So, right from the beginning, I had a feeling that, you shouldn't have to put up with something that was unfair. So I went down to my second meeting, and I was sitting there. I went and I signed up as a delegate, and I was sitting there, and somebody tapped me on the shoulder, and they said, you have to go behind the theater rope. I said, well, why? That's where the alternate sits, and all four of the delegates have come tonight. So they made sure I was not going to vote anymore. So my only ambition in the movement was to become a full delegate, so that nobody could tap me on the shoulder and send me behind the theater rope. So as things progressed, pretty soon I became a delegate, and I got in with a group of guys, and we would meet. The meetings were on Thursday once a month, so the Tuesday before the Thursday we would meet and we would make our plans. And we weren't very good at it. That was the night that they had the executive committee meeting, and the executive committee made far better plans than we ever made. So we got killed. Everything we tried to do, we got killed at. Including the first election. We had it all figured out. You only voted by the section that you were in. So we figured out you could win a seat on the executive committee with 40 votes. There were 11 of us. So all we had to do was, if everybody got four of the votes other than themselves, in the section that we were in, we could probably win. And we got killed. In fact, I only got 6 votes. So at the next meeting, I was really upset because I didn't get the votes of some of the guys I was meeting with. And so I learned about politics, you know, pretty fast then. So I lost a couple of times in the executive committee, and I came in the highest to lose once. And somebody resigned from the executive committee, and the president was a pretty good guy. He was an administrator, but he was a pretty good guy. He appointed me to the executive committee, and that's how I got started. And then I moved very rapidly. There were three vice presidents, third, second, and first. I was third vice president, and second vice president was a very nice lady who did membership by hand and never wanted to be anything except second vice president. And I felt I didn't want to run against her, and somebody else ran against her and beat her. And so the next time I ran for first vice president, I figured, well, you know, I might as well start moving up. And I became president. Not easily. Every election that I was in, I had to go to a runoff. I never won on the first ballot. And I became the president of the Buffalo Teachers Federation. When I was first vice president, it was the year the Taylor Law passed in New York, and I was the chairman of the negotiating committee. And then 2 years later, I was president. And when the next contract came up, we'd only gotten a two-year contract. So I was there really for two contracts. And I went on the board of the state association, which everybody advised me against. They said that at that time it was a cafeteria style. You didn't have to belong to anything to join the state, not the local or the national, not anything, or the local and not any of the other two. And I led a committee for what they call unification, that everybody in Buffalo would have to join the local, state, and the national on that. And I won on that. It was close, but I won. And then I went on the state board, and the fellow, we had two great vice presidents. Catherine Barrett was president, who was later president of the NEA. The two vice presidents were terrific, but since the Taylor Law had passed, we had opened a lot of regional offices in the state. And the second vice president, Jim Conte, became the staff director at the office we just left. There wasn't in that building, but he was the Western New York. So there was an opening for second vice president. And we assumed, there was about eight of us that voted together on the board, and we always lost. The scenario was that we would have these great arguments. It looked like we convinced the whole board. Somebody would move to close debate. Catherine Barrett would say, but we have to hear from the executive secretary before we vote. He would come on, and the vote would be always the same. Yeah. Eight yes, and you know, all these other things. So we said, we got to capture this vice presidency, because you know, we're never going to get anywhere in the operation unless we were able to move this ahead. So the other seven guys, and one woman, they all said they didn't want to run this time. They wanted to run next time.
Why not this time?
Well, this time would have been, there never was a contest for first vice president or president. There was only a contest for second vice president. And so, since 1 year of the term had been used, I'm sorry, there only were 1 year term, but everybody served 2 1-year terms. 1 year had been served. We assumed we'd have to put together a statewide operation politically in order to win the election. It was an election among the delegates. And so we thought the first year would be to build the structure, and we would lose to whoever was nominated by the nominating committee. But then we would have the structure in place, and we'd have somebody run the second year, and that person would win for first vice president, mm-hmm. and then be in a position to move up. So everybody said no, and then they all wanted me to run, not because anybody thought I was the best candidate, but they thought that Buffalo Teachers had the biggest treasury, and that I really didn't have a concern about being president, and so one of them could fill in next time. So I ran and I won.
They're wrong.
Yeah, they were wrong. Yeah, we won. It was overwhelming. They couldn't. It had always been a rotation, man, woman. And when Catherine Barrett ran, she ran against a man, Don Nixon from Lockport, who was an administrator. And her campaign was that this was a time of coming to, you know, teachers to the forefront and shouldn't be an administrator, which baffles me why Catherine took that position, because she didn't believe that. But anyway, she did, and she won on it. So there was two women in a row. And so there was a man as first vice president who was going to become president, and then she wanted to go back to the man-woman rotation. So she wanted a woman to run. And almost all the women, except one, was an administrator. Most of our board was administrators. And the one woman who was not an administrator finally agreed to run. And it was, I know I felt very bad about it. She was a very nice lady. She was from Thousand Island Central. Her name was Florence Vincent. And she, when she talked to the delegate, she told him she knew nothing about finances, but her husband agreed to tell her what to do on financial matters. And she wanted everybody to come to her suite, but she wanted to know she was temperance and there'd be no alcohol in her suite. And then we had the convention at the Waldorf, and she hadn't thought to call ahead to reserve a suite. So I don't know if you know the Waldorf, but it has a separate tower where you go up 20 floors, and then you have to walk down the hallway and another bank of elevators to go up in that tower. That's where a suite was. Nobody could find the place. So the lady did not have a campaign that was winnable. And Catherine Barrett wouldn't release the results of the election. And it turned out to be exactly 1,000 delegates. And she released the percentage. She must not have known there were 1,000 delegates. There was a pool out, and they finally convinced her she had to release something, so she released the percentage. And it was high 80s or low 90s. I mean, this lady had got creamed.
Yeah.
Because this was a time of militancy. You know, the law had just passed, and you know, people were coming forth. We were starting to have strikes in the state, which were a violation of the law, and it was a changing time. And this lady was from a different era. And Catherine, I guess, had not wanted to embarrass her to leave the, to make it people aware of what the vote was. That's the first election I ever won on the first ballot. So then the next year, I would have been, then I was first vice president. I won that without anybody running against me. But then when I ran for president, there were three candidates. Paul Cole was one.
Mm-hmm.
And
this was 71?
Yes.
Okay.
November. At that time, the convention was November. We were moving the convention from November to the spring so that we could have protests at the legislature. But we never met in Albany, so it was kind of a bad idea to do it. But in the off year, this Carl Hedstrom from Great Neck had run against Tom Smith, who was our second vice president. I was now first vice president. And Hedstrom had become second vice president. And, you know, I was having a very difficult time. We had an airplane, and they had a lot of demand for the speakers. And, you know, they would call me in the afternoon and say, well, you got to go to Long Island tonight. We're sending a plane for you. And I'd get home at 2 or 3 in the morning and be back at school.
Are you still teaching at this
yes,
time?
Yes,
yes. Oh.
And so I was chairman of the teacher rights committee. And we would have 2-hour long conference calls. Now the high school I was in only had 5 trunk lines. The principal would keep a log how long I was on the telephone for organizational business. He probably wouldn't have had a good case because up until this time they always gave a plush job to whoever was a state officer who didn't let me up. And I had tried to get us released full time, and this Hedstrom spoke against it. He gave a speech to a convention where we had this resolution up about how he had to be with the children in his classroom. And, so he never won any of this. I mean, he was always with his children because he didn't do anything better. So then when I ran for president, they were very upset at the Buffalo Teachers Federation. The delegate said, you know, what are you doing? You can't be president of this organization. President down here, we got so many problems. And I said, well, look, I can win this presidency. You know, there's two guys running against me. If I do win, I will not run again for president of Buffalo Teachers Federation. So I won.
You weren't expecting to win.
I wasn't expecting to win.
Why did you win that?
Well, this was the vice presidency that I told you about, but that would put you in line to become president.
Right.
So I dropped out. I was a vice president, dropped out, and I didn't win. But then when I ran for president, it was a good spirited campaign. I expected to win. But it was a runoff. You know, I didn't win on the first ballot, and we had a lot of time to politic because a guy by the name of Mel Chesty, who was from North Syracuse, had made a motion that Al be invited to come to the convention.
Schenck.
Who? And the president, Manny Kafka, had ruled that constitutionally one of the powers of the president was to invite guests to the convention. And that the delegates could have a constitutional amendment, and the next year the delegates could decide who to invite to the convention. But at this convention, it's up to the president to decide who was going to be invited. So Malcheski said that Al was over at, Syracuse for some reason, and over at the hotel, and could come across the street and talk to us. Turns out Al was in Europe or someplace like that. But anyway, it took 2 hours in this challenge to the chair about whether they could get Schenker to come to the convention. Now, all of the candidates were pro-merger. Tony Cortese was a candidate. And everybody was for a merger, but not at any cost. You know, we all had the same sort of merger, but not at any cost.
Mm-hmm.
And so in this two-hour period of time, Tony and I were the best ones working the audience to win, and we won.
Okay.
And so then we started off with a brand new group. And it was strange because this was the time of this intense feeling about teachers. And I was a guidance counselor. Ed Rogers, who was first vice president, was a social worker, or was an attendance teacher. And Tony was a social worker. I mean, we were a pupil personnel team. You know, in this time of teacher awareness, you know, that got elected. And It was pretty well known that the executive secretary had pushed for Paul to be president, and we think that Ned Hopkins had written a lot of stuff for Paul. And, but we ended up winning, and the executive secretary of 19 years had just retired, and I had been his first vice president and chairman of the selection committee for the new executive secretary, and I won't get into the story, but we got the wrong guy. It was a miscalculation on my part on the power move to get the guy that I wanted, and Catherine Barrett seized upon this to get the guy that she wanted.
Mm.
And the two titans ran into each other, and we got this dud. And he was really, really pompous.
His last name White?
White.
His wife, okay.
And so he called a meeting for the new officers. So he laid down the law to the new officers, which Tony and Ed said, you know, you gonna let him do this? He said, no, he's not gonna do that. So.
Oh, what did he say? I run.
Yes, yes. I'm in charge. Yeah, yes, you know, you're in charge of policy. I'm in charge of implementation. Now, policy occurs only at the board meeting. You know, in between the board meetings, I run the operation. You stay out of the way.
Right.
They said, no, he's not going to do that. So the first thing we had, we collected money for a teacher local was on a strike, Hudson, New York, and the delegates had collected the money and instructed the new president to deliver the money on the Monday. I told Dottie I was going to take her home at the end of the convention, you know, and the guy before me had come in on Monday, stayed over Monday night, worked Tuesday, got home Tuesday night. He was from Long Island. He'd work Long Island on Wednesday. He would come in on Thursday morning. He'd stay overnight Thursday night. He'd work Friday, go home. No weekend meetings except for the board. So I told Dottie, that's the schedule. So she, throughout the years, would always say, wait, you're going to be home on Wednesday? So I went back, and the executive secretary did not want to get involved in the strike. The word had come back that the teachers were going to go in on Tuesday. We had one more day of striking on Monday, and then they were going to go in. And all of the advisors to the executive secretary had said, except for this Ned Hopkins and this other fellow, Freddie Lambert, had said, we got to save the rest of the organization. This is a lost cause. You know, we're not going to support these people. And now White had explained to them that he'd made a huge concession. The new president was in town because he was going to go down to deliver this money in Hudson, and that he had invited me to come to a staff meeting so I could see what was happening. So White said, the president, let's ask the president what he says. I said, I just got elected. We ain't going to advise these people to go back into school. You know, we're going to support them so they stay out. So White said, well, the president's spoken, and I guess he's going to take care of that. And the meeting was over. So me and these other two guys said, man, I don't know what the hell we're going to do, you know?
Yeah.
So we drove down to Hudson. It's about 30 miles south of Albany. And we came up with a program to buy a double truck in Life magazine, which was still being published at that time, and print the picture of every scab across the picket line. And we'd bring 10,000 teachers into Hudson so that no merchant could make a sale that day. And we would hire private detectives to find out dirt on every board member and run every board member out of town.
You're doing radical union stuff here.
So we went to the meeting, we laid this out. Six people in the audience walked out on me. Walked out. But the rest of the people stood and cheered.
Yeah.
And so after the meeting, there was a call from the publisher of the newspaper who ran the town. And so we went over there and he was screaming, you goddamn carpetbagger, you come into my town and you stir up the teachers. We had them all set to go back to school and you're at fault for this stuff. So I said, well, I got a lot of work to do. I got to make arrangements with Life magazine for this double truck. I got to hire a private detective agency. And by the way, I'm putting your name on the list too, along with the board members. And I got to get 10,000 teachers here by tomorrow morning. So I said, we would really like to work this out tonight, but if we don't, you know, we'll see you tomorrow morning. So off I left and left a guy there. And by about 3 or 4 o'clock, there was a settlement and the teachers were back in school the next day. So I had to pay a $25,000 fine because the Taylor Law says you can either encourage, condone, or support a public employee work stoppage. And that was unfortunate because the president before me had paid a fine once because we had always contended that we didn't support or condone. We were only there to try to get a settlement so the teachers would go back to school.
Right.
Because the fine is, there's been a court case that said it's against the size of the treasury. So if we got convicted, it was a full state treasury that they could get. But we'd never had a conviction after that, so we learned a lot from that. Of conviction, but we got everybody back. So that was the start of my my presidency. And of course, all the delegates were ecstatic, because they collected money for this, and this local got a settlement. So this new president went down and did something, and everything worked out. So then we decided we're gonna, you know, we had to live up to this pledge we had on merger. This was November. So we called for Al to Johnson had just said he'd negotiate on any ship on any sea for settlement in Vietnam. So we called upon Al to come to any ship on any sea to talk about teacher unity in New York State. And Al wrote back a very nice letter saying that George Meany had asked him to be a AFL-CIO representative in some African nation on something like that. And we sent back a ship letter that said, are you not aware that there are African Americans in New York State? You should be here talking about teacher unity. To which later on, you know, I said, "Well, you know, I'm really sorry that you sent that letter." And pragmatic Al said, "Well, we were in a dispute, you know. That, I thought that was a pretty good move on your part."
Yeah, right.
She said, "Well, thanks, Al. I'm still sorry that I sent you the letter." But
so these are basically volley shots to each other.
Yes,
the beginning
of
merger.
Yes. So the 6th of December, we had the first meeting. And Frank White had sat down and said, this is a staff operation. The board sets a policy that you know, we should pursue merger. It's a staff operation to set down the details. And then we will bring back the best deal we can, and the board will decide if that's good enough, because they set policy. And he said, so I'll take care of setting up this meeting. I said, well, just make sure my calendar's free. Oh, yes, certainly. Well, I'll make sure that you know that you're involved too, Tom. And I said, and make sure Tony and Ed's calendars are free too. Oh, no. We cannot have the vice presidents there. Says, you can't. Said, Frank, they're going to be there. Make sure the calendars are free.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they're teaching full time. I'm on full time release now, which is a good thing, because in the fall, when we started school, I'm no longer president of the Buffalo Teachers Federation. The election has been in May. I've been replaced as president there. Come in September, when we come into school, the principal, assistant principal there, he says, the principal has quit because there's a force on the faculty that's disruptive. And we all thought it was Miss McCarthy. Miss McCarthy had a terrible BO, and she didn't teach, and we thought that was the
case.
The assistant principal refused to identify the disruptive force until the faculty, in unison, demanded to know, and he says, well, it's Hobart. I said, me? That was it. About me? Well, you know, the principal had been very upset. When I got to the school, I'd wanted to be a guidance counselor in a high school. I was a guidance counselor in kindergarten and first grade, and I was just not cut out for it. So it was, it's a little kid, bad day. Yeah, why is it a bad day? Oh, Uncle Johnny was over. Uncle Johnny won't let me sleep with him and Mom. Uncle George will let me sleep with him and Mom. Uncle Pete will let me sleep with him and Mom. But I have a bad day when I'm out of it. I don't want to hear this stuff. You know? And so finally, this guy, Connors at South Park, said, I found out later at the principal meeting where they'd said, look, this is the president of the Buffalo Teachers Federation. We can't keep saying no to him. There's openings. You know, somebody's got to take him. And Connor says, I can handle him. Send him to me. So that's the way I went there. So the first thing I did is I had under the contract, we had a building committee that would try to head off grievances.
Uh-huh.
Well, he refused to meet with us. I will not. You will meet with my advisory committee. I will not meet with you. Can I use your phone? My phone? There's a phone out there. I said, what? This phone's right here. Can I use your phone? Who are you going to call? I said, the superintendent. What are you going to call him for? I said, this is a contract matter. Well, I'll call him. So he called the superintendent. Yeah, and I have this teacher standing here in front of me. He wants to talk to you. So the superintendent must say, okay, put him on the phone. He said, he won't meet with us. You know, the contract says, uh-huh. Should I meet with us? I said, is this going to be our first arbitration? The superintendent said, let me talk to the principal. So the turns bright red. I will not. All right, I'll meet with him. Boom, he said. So Where I'd been at, it'd been, everybody was in the Buffalo Teachers Federation. I find that at South Park, there's about 20 members, it's 125 on the faculty